Hello, and welcome to Candid Conversations, Catalyst McGill's International Development Podcast. On this podcast, we explore current issues in international development around the world. I'm your host, Carla, a third-year political science student at McGill. On today's episode of Candid Conversation, I, alongside Zoe Pellin, another staff member of Candid Conversation, got the opportunity to sit down and talk to Waleed Iqbal, a writer at Catalyst, about his article, The Trump Challenge, How MAGA Populism is Destroying the Republican Party. Today, we have the pleasure of being joined by Waleed Iqbal. He is a fourth-year political science and history student. Being a Pakistani who was born and raised in Saudi Arabia, his third culture upbringing tends itself to where his areas of interest lie, international relations and politics in the Middle East and South Asia, with a specific interest in imperialism in the Global South. Waleed, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for having me, Carla and Zoe. I'm very, very excited for the upcoming podcast.
So, Waleed, you wrote an article for Catalyst where you discuss the Republican primary that happened these past few months. Of course, a lot has changed since then, but your article primarily examines the dynamics within the Republican Party. And what prompted you to write about that?
Well, you know, I have been watching American politics for a while now. I've been watching from the sidelines since I was younger, and more particularly once I got to university. I came to see since 2016, how the political system works in America. And when you look at both parties and what they have to offer, the primary season and election season is meant to be a time where there is important discussion on what American values are, what American values they want to focus on, what priorities Americans have in the upcoming 4 years. And, you know, when you see suddenly this rise in lots of one-sided sound bites from each side, you realize there's a endemic problem within America itself. And I just wanted to look into that, at least an aspect of it. You know, one article isn't enough to cover all of that, but at least give us somewhat of a indication of what we could do, you know.
For the listeners who may not know what populism is, can you give a baseline definition of it?
Of course. So I was actually reflecting on this, you know, before coming here. So populism, for better or for worse, when there are actual legitimate grievances against an established elite group, for example, populist leaders can emerge who can offer simple formula solutions to very complex problems. And these often come in the form of repeating grievances, but without actual proper solutions, often like how we see Donald Trump presenting very easy solutions to very complex problems, for example, the Ukraine war. This is basically what populism is. It's the idea of using legitimate grievances against the elite establishment to further an individual cause. But as a whole, though, populism could serve for the better of people when there are, because there are actual legitimate grievances. But what we see with populist leaders is they usually tend to use the popularity they gain through exploiting people's grievances for their own gain. For be it winning a presidential election or be it having a position of power which could help them and their family and friends financially, you know?
Yeah. And populism as an ideology, it's kind of important to point this out. It could be right-wing and it could also be left-wing. Mm-hmm. Do you think that like right-wing populism is more like insidious than left-wing populism? Or is it just that we see more right-wing populism so we're more inclined to talk about it than mm-hmm. left-wing populism?
I think it really lends itself, it depends on the political climate itself that we're in. In the current political climate, I do feel where there is multiculturalism in different countries, right-wing populism could be more dangerous in terms of, you have seen a lot of, let me just be clear in regards to, there's fringe extremes on each side that commit heinous acts. But right now, I'm particularly referring to right-wing extremists. And by extremists, I mean a very slim 1% who have committed atrocious acts against Muslims. Like, for example, the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand, lots of school shootings and racially hate-motivated shootings in worshipping areas in the past years. There's so many to say from, you know, it's hard to, like, pick one. But, you know, I think there has been populists, leftist demands in the past in history that have been dangerous too, have seen dangerous consequences. But I think in the current political climate, there is a slight bit more danger to right-wing populism itself. Though I do think it wouldn't be right to demonize all right-wing people who hold the right-wing views as extremists, because I do think there is a lot there that are actual legitimate grievances that do need to be addressed. And part of the problem is in the media is that these people are all grouped together as extremists, which only creates a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know?
Yeah. Can you elaborate on the challenges faced by Republican candidates in appealing to different segments of party base, including Trump voters, moderate conservatives, and young voters?
Of course. So, you know, in this particular primary season, what we all could see, I'm pretty sure the patterns we could make out was there was definitely a very strange feeling that Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis were not speaking their minds about Donald Trump. Back in 2020, as we remember, right after the January 6th attempted insurrection, we had many Republican people, Nikki Haley included, Mitch McConnell included, many who actively spoke out against Trump, calling him a danger to the Republican Party, saying that he was a force that had to be removed. But it's so surprising to me to see that all of a sudden they are very, very worried to even attack Trump. The reason behind that is there has been a split in the Republican Party where you see a 50-50 between moderate Republicans who just want conservative values to be expressed in their elections and their leaders. And then you have the other 50% that are, I wouldn't say they're extremists, but I would say that they are standing behind Trump, which kind of sets this precedent for Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis to have a more difficult time going against that. It just makes it difficult for them to speak their mind. Though I think they should be more honest to their, for this, they are more afraid of losing out on the more pro-Trump voters than actually addressing issues that against Trump that I feel are very dangerous towards the American democracy, very dangerous towards, you know, the international situation in general.
So, like, internationally, you have people like Javier Milei in Argentina, Giorgia Meloni in Italy. You might have Donald Trump once more. You almost had Marine Le Pen in France. What do you think explains this, like, rise of far-right populism? So is it just the rest of the world emulating what's happening in the United States? Or is that, like, completely separate phenomenon that's just happening worldwide and it's just, like, a coincidence of sorts?
Well, I think it's, to a degree, the reason why the U.S. is very influential in world politics in general is because it kind of is the it gives a barometer of the political patterns in the world in general. So I think the rise in far-right, like, populism in general comes for the past 5-6 years, we've seen an increase in, you know, in migrations, and we've seen an increase in a lot of sudden changes in politics. The Trump coming into office in 2016, people seeing how that played out, you know, a sudden shift in political culture. And I think from that, on top of that, we live in now, since Trump's inauguration, we've only, while I'm speaking more towards American political climate, there's only been more polarization. And when you have polarization between the Democrat Party, who, frankly, people have just lost trust for in terms of recently, if we look at Biden's actions in you know, vetoing all the ceasefire resolutions and in Gaza and in it kind and also Obama's failure in Syria and in Libya, it sets a hypocritical standard for Democrats, and they've very much isolated independent voters who now see Trump as, despite his shortcomings, they see him as this man who could bring back stability, you know? And at the end of the day, I think the question of, can we really blame them when you have a system where the both parties are complicit in allowing this corrupt military and bureaucratic and corporate establishment that holds on to actual proper policymaking? Because it's both Democrats and Republicans who are to blame for Trump coming up. Trump only becomes more powerful the more instability they have. And these leaders in these countries, they come up against this establishment that is always, that tends to be outdated, you know?
Yeah.
And these are legitimate grievances. However, when one man comes with simple solutions to fix it, it doesn't tend to work out that way in the end, you know? And I think also we live in an era now, especially with the rise of TikTok and with the rise of 30-second videos, you know, to pack huge amounts of information. It's so easy to make one soundbite or one infographic that removes all nuance from all, you know, be it anything from the left or the right. And when that happens, there's lots of bits for people to assume, lots of bits for people to make assumptions on and fill in the gaps. And because of that, there is an information crisis going on.
So we also have Zoe Pellin here, who is from France, and you've lived in France during...
My entire life.
Your entire life. So, like, how would you explain, like, the rise of sort of Front National and, like, Marine Le Pen and, like, her appeal as a politician? Because if I remember correctly, like, 20-ish years ago, that party was taken as a joke, and now it's, like, very much not a joke.
Yeah, I mean, it has changed because for me, like, the main shift that had happened, it was before to vote for Le Front National, it was not seen as cool. Now, they're, like, people my age, they're, like, revendicating that they're voting for them, and it's not perceived as, like, as radical as before, I think, in a way. And also, I think that with, like, you mentioned it, with immigration and mostly, like, the fear that people are actually expressing, I think it's giving them, like, a momentum to act, and especially, like, with, like, the term that just Macron is like finishing, people are not happy with what he's doing and they're like expressing it, and we've got a lot of protests for different reasons. Now it's like the agricultural sector, and it's just like people are unhappy, they want to change, and they're like, these populist leaders are like providing these changes, yeah. And they're like making big statements and people are actually believing them. So, yeah, it's quite scary, actually.
And, I mean, you have all these, like, populist leaders in, like, Europe, and, like, doesn't that, like, in a way, like, threaten a bit, like, the European Union or, you know,
it's
like, NATO?
It's like a trend. Yeah. You see Italy, you see the Netherlands, even, like, everywhere. It's just, I don't know. I'm taking a class on nationalism and the far right, and the prof is just talking about the fact that it's nationalism has always been there, and it's just like some person are just able to manipulate it as they want it to look like. So I think they're just like riding this wave for now. About like other populist leader, do you have any example of like another part of the world, like maybe on like Southeast Asia or the Middle East? Do you think like it's a different rhetoric, or is it like comparable in a sense?
So I'm glad you brought up, you know, populist leaders in Southeast Asia, because just recently we had an election in Pakistan where the majority vote went to Imran Khan, who by all definitions is a populist leader. He ran his, and for good, better or for worse, he ran his entire platform was based off anti-corruption. And granted, he never really, throughout his campaign in 2018, he never really addressed the elephant in the room, which was that the problems he was talking about were from the military establishment. Yet it was the same military establishment that bought him in 2018. And following this, when he lost the vote of no confidence, which was democratic in most regards, it was in line with the constitution, he suddenly started obstructing the democratic processes, started appointing new prime minister, shut down the dissolved the assembly so the votes can't, if I'm not wrong, like, he was just obstructing a lot of the processes. And granted, I understand and I do stand behind the noble reasons that he was running for, but the obstruction that came from his populist rhetoric, I think that within itself, the signals, the missignaling he sent during this time to the IMF, and just the way he went about it, it caused more harm than good for Pakistan, but people don't seem to recognize that because his populist brand and charm is very high, you know? But, you know, at the end of the day, what I will concede to is Imran Khan's running on the right reasons, that he wants to do what's best for his people. But you can kind of see that when it suited him and when he had the ability to become prime minister, he took it, even though it was given to him by the same people he was calling out. And this is what I mean by populist leaders like Trump. They don't mind the problems once they are in power. In fact, the same things that Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton on, rightfully so, about nepotism, about corruption, were the same problems that he was doing when he became president.
Stefan Lundberg, who is the director of Varieties of Democracy Institute, characterized 2024 as a critical juncture for global democracy, with 49% of the global population going to the polls, many influential countries involved. The concern is heightened by the empowerment of leaders of parties with anti-democratic inclinations. Would you agree with this assessment? So the idea globally is that, you know, like 2024 is a big election year. Almost half of the world population is going to vote. And he says this is essentially like a referendum on democracy, because you have a lot of big countries like, you know, the United States that are going to vote, and that whatever they vote on is going to have a lot of like repercussions for like not just their countries, but also for like democracy as you conceive it. Do you like agree with that?
I do, actually. Yes, I think there is the leaders we are seeing now. It does kind of give, I don't want to, you know, fear monger, but the inclinations and the signals that have been coming from Trump and from other populist leaders, the signals being given by Trump and other populist leaders running it, they're not too hopeful, you know?
Yeah.
But granted, I also do believe that when Trump did come to 2016, such scares were there as well. But with the constitutional system in America, if things go right, there are checks and balances that will keep Trump from doing anything too audacious. However, that being said, we do see there's a huge split within the Republican Party, with what Trump's saying on one end about funding to Ukraine, funding to other wars, and the signals he's sending versus what senators are saying in the Republican caucus, who are very, very stubborn on their support to Ukraine. And I think that will be come into play if Trump does win the presidency this year. That will definitely be a factor of coming to governance, of how he will reconcile his broken caucus and how.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it does take me back to the political climate in the 1930s, which was characterized by somewhat similar features of what we're going through today. You know, high inflation and a potential economic crisis. People are not. The frank truth is people are struggling, you know, and when people are struggling, people want to have a government they will think is strong enough to protect them and their rights. And that's where it does become a bit concerning, because the current candidates, Trump's, you know, own anti-democratic rhetoric and his more hardline than 2016 rhetoric now, it is signaling somewhat of a worrying future. Though I do hope that the checks and balances that, you know, each democracy has, and that each democracy has been encouraged to have in the post 1945 world order, to avoid having another situation of the 1930s where lots of democracies suddenly flipped into authoritarian regimes. I do hope those checks and balances that we have created over time do come into play and do avoid a situation like that. But, you know, you never know until you're there, so.
2 weeks ago, Donald Trump said that he would encourage Russia to attack any of the U.S.'s NATO allies whom he considers have not met their financial obligation. As indicated in your article, Trump's approach lacks nuance in foreign policy matters. How do you anticipate a potential second Trump presidency unfolding on the global political stage?
Well, you know, that's the thing. You know, he literally lacks nuance. It's interesting that, you know, when we look at Trump's future and the signals he's given about how he wants to run his presidency, you really can't tell, be it domestic issues or be it foreign policy issues. And even when you look at his tenure from 2016 to 2020, he had some achievements that were remarkable, like, and in foreign policy. And then he had other achievements, I'd say, that weren't so remarkable and were actually turned out to be very detrimental. Yeah, in the Middle East in particular, in Syria and in Iran, there have been some missteps. However, it seems because from what we're getting from Trump, he wants to become more economically isolationist on the world stage, which would make sense if that's what he wants and that's what Americans want. However, in regards to military action and in regards to NATO, there's a mixed signal of we don't know what he wants, you know?
Yeah.
On one end, he has, in his presidency itself from 2016 to 2020, we see that he had somewhat of an interventionist approach in when he shot one of the Iranian generals, and that nearly caused a destabilization between in the region, you know. But it was just the fact that it's Trump's not as experienced in these matters, and there's a lot of precedents and there's a lot of matters and a lot of things you need to consider that more experienced politicians, like, I'll give it to Biden for, you know, I've not agreed with Biden's stance and his inability to do anything about the ongoing crisis in Gaza. But I will say about Biden is he and his team are experienced. They have done lots of work in foreign policy, and to the bare minimum, they have somewhat of a shred of empathy in regards to they can understand what to do in a situation where there's a crisis much more better than what Trump would do and his team would do. Because I feel had they been inherited with a crisis like this, it could have gone much more worse. It could have potentially even gone nuclear for all we know, you know?
Yeah.
But it's the matter of the experience you bring there.
Could you give a little bit more information about Vivek Ramaswamy? Because it was the first time I heard of them.
So Vivek Ramaswamy was an interesting character, interesting candidate that ran this primary season. And what's interesting about him is he diverges from what you would expect a typical Republican populist candidate to be. You know, you see Ron DeSantis and you mm-hmm. see Donald Trump and you see these recent waves of people who've been winning. And you've never seen someone that's been a person of color, you know. But Vivek Ramaswamy is a very accomplished Indian-American man who came forward and had a very interesting vision. But as he carried on speaking and as he was asked and pressed on more critical issues, I came to notice that there was somewhat of a... For example, what he said about Taiwan was... He wanted to change American policy into an ambiguous state with Taiwan where they don't really specify whether or not they'll defend Taiwan because he wants to have more of an isolationist approach. I think that's just taking out every single precedent and every single rule that the US has set for itself in foreign policy from the 1960s. And if you just obstruct all that, it may sound easy to just say, yeah, we won't help Taiwan when things get hard because we have other problems. But as America, you have spent 60 years with this foreign policy and you have allies that depend on you. And there are some foreign policy matters that I think about, there's absolutely no nuance. But one interesting thing about Vivek Ramaswamy is he really does challenge the notion that, you know, right, these extremists are...
But when you imagine a populist, you imagine like... a white person spewing xenophobic rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And Vivek Ramaswamy really challenges that.
What I think I saw with Vivek was they saw Vivek as a fellow American first. And you know what? One thing I have gathered from a lot of these populist leaders is they are able to... they know the problems of America. There is a border crisis. There is an economic crisis. There is a lot of things that are wrong. But the manner in which they go about presenting these issues harbors xenophobic rhetoric, it harbors racist comments, it harbors a lot of things that attract people who have this certain mindset, but it also attracts people who might not necessarily think that way, but would see that. But with Vivek, the interesting thing is he didn't go that far in the polls, and that I do wonder, does that beg the question of if he was white, a Caucasian man, would he have gotten more of a vote? But I guess 7% in the Iowa caucus was still a pretty significant change. Yeah. And I guess that does indicate that there's a very big... a lot of people are just looking for anyone that can just say what solutions there are. Because there are a lot of legitimate grievances in American politics that get lost between the binary of Republican and Democrat, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of nuance that can't be expressed because both parties pretty much agree on 90% of the things, and then 10% is the things they have in different, but that 10% is overly exploited by the media and by their own party members.
Yeah, I know it's a pretty broad question, but do you think that in a way, like, I know you mentioned it in your article, but do you think, like, Trump is destroying the Republican Party? Is it, like, or is it, like, changing it?
Yeah, it's like he's, like transforming it beyond recognition in a way.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I used the word destroy in my article initially when I wrote it because back then it seemed more indicating that Trump was losing. But I would still say destroy because when I think of Republican Party, the values I think of are Reagan values. I think of the values of free markets, the protection of freedom, the protection of civil liberties, the conservation of the Constitution, extremely important, that one, you know, the Constitution itself. And the brand of politics that Trump offers, it seems to be very, very entrenched in his individual personality of tweeting mean things and saying what people would have thought, you know, which
mm-hmm.
I feel a president necessarily shouldn't be saying that. A president should be a role model. He should be the one to give, his character should be one that people look at and they think, oh, that's a very nice man, you know, that's a gentleman, you know, that's someone you can trust.
Mm-hmm.
I feel with Trump, granted, there is a big chance he might win the 2024 election. What he stands for, I feel, is absolutely destroying the good parts of the Republican Party and making them into this very much racist, xenophobic party that would rather divide the country than unite it. Though I don't necessarily blame Republican voters for that because I do think this problem isn't entirely Trump's doing. This problem is very much the doing of Democrats too. The same Democrats who sit in Congress, who are very corrupt, who use and who do insider trading, who have been complicit in not changing things for their constituents. Who have happily stood by, allowed the rich to get richer, allowed tax cuts for the rich 1% while campaigning towards the middle class and lower class for their votes and then leaving them dry every election season. They made their bed and I think it's time for them to be very honest to lay in it because I feel Democrats love to say, oh, Trump's the problem, Trump's done this, Trump's done that. But a lot of the times, their own caucus and their own leaders, they, granted, I will say there have been Democrats somewhat do have a spine here and there. They have been complicit as well in the grievances that people fail in failing to address the grievances that people have.
So Zoe, you're European.
Yeah.
Do you know when is the French election?
Okay, so the next one is in 2026.
2027, apparently. May 2027.
2027. Sacré. I'm supposed to know that.
Yeah, so that's like three-ish years away.
What?
That's about like three-ish years away. Where do you see it going? Because Macron's not popular at all.
No.
I don't follow French politics, but I know that Macron is not well-liked by pretty much anyone. Do you think that like there might be like a person from, I believe his party is called En Marche? Do you think that there's going to be a person from En Marche that's going to be able to, like, rise up to the occasion, or from the Republicans, or from Les Républicains?
No, Les Républicains, it's just a mess.
Or from, I don't know what the other parties are, but do you think that there's, like, someone that's going to be able to be, like, a formidable challenge?
I don't know if you've heard of that. It's, like, social justice, ecology. It's a political party founded by Jean-Luc Mélenchon in 2022. I think this one, for me, is the most, not promising because it's not the right word, but like it's getting more and more popular. And as I was saying before, especially with the young people and like the more traditional party, like the Republicans, it's not popular anymore. But I don't really know. I just, tend to see that people are like not getting sick of politics, but they're getting more and more like they have a lot of grievances, as you said before, and they're just gonna express themselves or just not going to vote. And for me, this is the worst, because I don't know if you heard, but like the absenteeism is going up and up, and especially yeah. with like people my age, like my friend, they're like, I don't want to vote, like why? So I think this is gonna be the most important features yeah. about the next election. But yeah,
and I think that's a worldwide phenomenon of people being very disillusioned and choosing not to vote because they don't like the options presented to them. We're going through a lot of problems with, you know, inflation, crisis of housing in most, like, you know, Western countries. What else? Grocery prices are going up. The cost of living is going up. Education is really a problem. I think it's going up pretty much everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's becoming harder and harder to live. You know, wages are not keeping up with inflation. And I think a lot of people are just really looking to, like, people who can fix everything. But the problem is the people who tell you that they can fix everything, that usually should be the people you should be the most wary
Absolutely,
of.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that is the thing, is right now when people are scared and when there's nothing to look up to, you want to hear someone tell you everything's going to be all right. You want to hear people tell you, oh, it'll all be okay. But you know the problem with, and I guess, you know, when they say a democracy is the most imperfect, best system to have, what they mean is that, you know, a democracy is not going to be perfect, but it is the best way for us to govern ourselves out of all the ways there are. And here's one of the flaws of a democracy is when you have an election every 4 years, politicians want to focus on the short-term things, you know, that will make people happy. Like, you know, stimulus packages or symbolic victories, you know, changing a name of a state to something or doing something that would, you know, suit the people. But actual big long-term reforms, things that would change people, make huge change and make structural proper change, a lot of politicians shy away from because they don't want to upset their constituents. They don't want to tax their constituents. They don't want to do something that will go off the ordinary or make them lose their election. And I think when you have that going on, and you know, when you have the very slow progress to, and the problems just keep piling up and up, people get scared, you know, people get nervous. And you know, not everyone is sitting around reading every political story. Some people are just half informed, you know, because lots of people are busy around there. You know, I think of it like, you know, for example, a grown 40-year-old man who works every day, you know, a middle-class 34-year-old man who's working a 9-to-5. He doesn't really have the time to sit around and, like, catch up on what is going on. You know, he just wants to see a leader that will step up to what he hopes is his values. And when you have, you know, leaders like Trump that come up and say things that he feels like, crime has gone up, I'll stop it. The border crisis is out of control, we will build that wall and deport every illegal refugee. And, you know, stuff like that, people tend to find this, okay, at least he'll get something done.
So do you have a final question? Or?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Oh, okay, you get to ask the final question.
Earlier, you mentioned the fact that populist politicians tend to be like counterexamples of role model. But do you think that, isn't it like their entire rhetoric to not be a role model, to have like a, to be vulgaire?
Yeah, vulgar, like alternative.
Not rude. Comment tu dis vulgaire?
Like of the, like in a way it's like anti-establishment, you're like of yeah. the people, you're not with the like classy stuff.
Do you think, isn't it their strategy to be like, I'm like you guys? Do you think, like, isn't it just obvious that they should be like this?
Like, elaborate a little, you know, like, you mean like they want to vulgar as in like, did you say vulgar, sorry?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and like, for example, Trump will say some, you know, questionable words to appeal to the common people. Yeah,
yeah. But do you think that politicians should be a role model? That's the bottom line.
Well, you know, I think, granted, politicians should be honest with their people. I think that's something. And role model as in, I don't expect them to be perfect people. I just expect them to do the right thing, you know, as leaders. Because I feel from a very top level, you need to have someone that is representing the nation in a way that is right, you know, because a democracy is, in my eyes, in my opinion, I 100% believe a democracy is a reflection of the people themselves in terms of what the state is of the society, you know.
Okay.
So, for example, when you have a leader that you want to elect a leader that will present you as how you want to be presented, you know.
Okay.
You want to have someone that you can work with, someone, you know. I don't get me wrong. One thing about Trump that I can make a case for is he gives an element of realness to people, mm-hmm. you know, this idea of I'm real and I'm not this artificially marketed politician. But I do think, I 100% believe you could be an excellent role model for people. And you don't have to be a typical marketed one-liner politician, you know, like what Trump attacks about those Washington politicians who have their rehearsed lines and know what to say. You don't have to be that to be a role model. You could be someone that just does the right thing, you know, when it's called for. Knows how to be empathetic, does not resort to personal, useless attacks on their opponents, as Trump does, you know. I feel things like that, it's giving the impression that he's not there to cooperate, he's there to assert a dominance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's a problem, you know, where it's like, you're in politics, there's no better way to get things done than to compromise with people and to learn from other people's values. Because all of us believe we're right, but it's a matter of how can we make sure that the people around us all feel that they had somewhat of an influence on the events around us, you know? Everyone needs to have some sort of say, and the best way to do that is through actual proper talking and through cooperation, not through saying, I'm right, and you're going to listen to me, you know?
Yeah, that's thank a... Yeah, thank you. That was a perfect way to cap off the episode. Thank you so much for being with us, Waleed.
Thank you, Zoe and Carla, for having me. It was very excellent conversation.
You can check out his article on Catalyst.
Thank you once again to Waleed, and thank you for listening to this episode of Candid Conversations. Candid Conversations is a Catalyst McGill production. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Catalyst McGill. And you can find us on Instagram at IDSSA Publications.